If you'd like to listen to our podcasts without ads, please consider becoming a member. In addition to no ads, members receive bonus content for virtually all of our shows, an invitation to join the DSR Slack community, access to our Discord community, enhanced show notes for select shows, and more. For this week only, get 50% off the first year or the first month of membership. Visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy and use code ECLIPSE to receive the discount. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy and code ECLIPSE. Thank you very much for your support.
Nine, 12, 10, 28, 2, 23.
This is Deep State Radio, coming to you direct from our super secret studio in the third sub-basement of the Ministry of Snark in Washington, D.C., and from other undisclosed locations across America and around the world.
Hello and welcome to our political podcast. Every month, sometimes more frequently, if we're lucky, we get to sit down with our two favorite, smartest political observers, Tara McGowan, who is the Empress, I think her title is, of the Courier Newsrooms, and Simon Rosenberg, who is the King of Hopium, also recently, and let's just start there. You know, New York Times cover boy. Like, what was going on with that, man? I mean, you know, I remember when you were obscure like 2 months ago. And I mean, what's happening?
My favorite thing is they called to do, you know, I'd done an interview with Adam Nagurny, who was an old friend. And then they called and said, we want to come take your picture. I'm like, you know, I work out of my house, you know, and like I have a dog, but I don't have any meetings this week. And, you know, and it was just very funny. So the pictures is like me in my house meeting with a guy who works for me 2 hours a day, Lincoln Cooper, a good friend. And but anyway, it was a lot of fun. I thought the piece was good. And it's helped generate an important conversation. You know, I've been able to go now on CNN several times. I've gone on MSNBC several times talking about the piece. I'm going to go back on CNN two more times the next few days, all around this idea that the election is changing. It's getting better for Biden. We should be optimistic about our opportunities. You know, twist my arm that I get to go talk about that on national television, right?
Well, look, I'm glad you're out there. You looked very beautiful in your picture.
A little chubby, I think, but I'm going to work on that.
Jesus Christ, Judaism is such a curse, isn't it? Tara, I saw you gave him a shout out for his great piece in the Times. I mean,
I don't want to encourage any of our listeners to Google profiles on me, but they are not nearly as glowing. So I want some advice on that front. It was very, very, very well deserved, and I thought well done.
I don't know. You deserve a glowing profile. Somebody out there listening, Tara McGowan deserves a glowing profile.
There are profiles. I describe them as glowing.
Well, they ought to be. You are doing the Lord's work also. So let's sort of pick things up where they are this week. I mean, if I go to Real Clear Politics, it looks like Trump is leading in everything. But then again, I don't trust Real Clear Politics anymore. Where do you think we are, Simon, just in sort of the finger in the wind of the campaign? Here we are sort of 6 months out.
Well, you shouldn't go to Real Clear Politics. I mean, it's a propaganda site. And
where should somebody go?
Well, I mean, 538 is still the best, and it's still the best place. And you can just go look at the polls that they put up, right? I mean, you can make your own judgment. But look, there is something happening, is that sometime in late February, early March, Biden's numbers started going up, at least in the head-to-head with Trump. And we've now had, in the recent weeks, a majority of polls in the last 2 weeks have had Biden leading. The Economist poll tracker now has Biden ahead of Trump. Many of the prediction markets have Biden ahead of Trump. Many of the betting markets have Biden ahead of Trump now. And I think, you know, we are in a close competitive election that's getting bluer. It's important to recognize the congressional generic has also improved. Our Senate polling all across the country is holding. We don't have any Senate race where we're sort of struggling or doing worse than we expected. And so on balance, you know, if you add to that the fact that our party is strong and unified and raising lots of money, and the Republicans have the ugliest political leader in American history and the raging dumpster fire of a party on their side, I think that, you know, six and a half months out, I'd much rather be us than them. And I think the election is changing and it's getting more favorable to us. We still have a long way to go and a lot of work to do, but I'd much rather be us than them.
You know, I love your analyses. You know, I read all the Hopium stuff and your Substack and your tweets and, you know, stuff like that, things you carve on trees around Palisades in Washington. And it's always kind of direct. It's like, you know, thoughtful political consultant, analyst kind of commentary. And Donald Trump is the worst person who ever lived. You know, it's like, because he is, you know, yeah. And you don't, it's like, let's not let that get lost in all of this. Now, he may be the worst person who ever lived, but you have to admit, Tara, in the middle of all of this, the Republican Party is proving itself to be like, so, I mean, it's extreme. Their views are awful, but it also seems unbelievably self-destructive. This week, the Arizona Supreme Court decided to uphold a law that was passed in 1864, before Arizona was a state. Before, you know, I looked it up, it was 15 years before Wyatt Earp got to Tombstone, Arizona. Wyatt Earp was only 16 years old when this law was passed. Other contemporary laws of the time said you could marry somebody as long as they were 9 years old, and that you could beat your child to death and it would be okay since you were the parent. So, I mean, this was not a particularly enlightened period in American legal history. And surely this is going to show up on the ballot, just like the Florida stuff is going to show up on the ballot, just like we're going to see this state to state. And there is a sense I have from a lot of people, and I'd be interested in your view, that the abortion, the issue, women's right to control their own body, women's right to get the health care they need, could be the biggest issue this year and seems to be getting bigger. What's your view?
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I have never had a doubt that it would continue to be the biggest and most important issue to the most voters. Republicans are ensuring that where there was a period of time right after the Dobbs decision where they were trying to distance themselves from this issue and talk about a lot of other issues. And then the judges that they have put in place in these courts for a very long-term, concentrated, intentional strategy to be able to overturn decisions like this are coming into play. We saw this right with Alabama, with IVF as well. And suddenly all of these Republicans trying to distance themselves, saying they are not opposed to this. They will come up with all of these bills to protect IVF, protect people who get IVF. We're seeing the same thing. I just got a tracker from my team before this podcast about our Arizona newsroom, Copper Courier, they've already published over 30 different stories and videos in response to this decision. And one of them that's been making its rounds is all of the state Republicans in Arizona trying to distance themselves from this. And the thing is, they can't, because this has been part of their plan for a very long time. And they're not going to be able to distance themselves from it, because the American people know that this is their doing, that this is their agenda, and it is incredibly extreme and out of touch. And we know that even in really red states like Kansas and red states like Ohio, that when abortion is on the ballot, a bipartisan majority of voters come out to protect it. And so this is a really, really egregious bill and move by the Arizona Supreme Court that not only would prosecute women for seeking an abortion, but it may also prosecute health providers who provide them. And that is a question that is being debated right now, but there are no exceptions in this law that, as you mentioned, David, was designed before Arizona was even a state. So the fact that this is a strategy that they're deploying and they're effectively getting the courts to uphold is, I think, unfortunately, could have a lot of women suffer in the interim and will, and we will see that if the courts uphold this, and yet is a massive mobilizing force for Democrats and for Biden in this election year.
Yeah, no, I mean, the Arizona law was passed before Simon was even involved in politics. I mean, not a long time, but somewhat. But you know, here we have Trump on Monday going, Simon, I think it should be left to the states, and I'm not really into this nationwide ban. And like 24 hours later, this drops in his lap.
It was incredible timing.
Yeah, I know, it was awful. And then the next day he's like, well, we'll fix this. This is not the way it's going to go. And Carrie Lake is like, this is terrible. I'm not for this. And then like 1 second later, somebody hits play on her saying, I'm totally for this. So, you know, they're kind of stuck, aren't they, Simon?
Yeah, a couple points. One is that Trump actually didn't say, we'll fix this. He said, the Democrats have to go fix it. right. Which was even, I mean, you know, talk about a guy who just looked like a deer caught in headlights, cowardly, you know. I mean, just this was a horrific week for Donald Trump, because on Monday, he looked like a coward who couldn't make a tough decision on an issue that was obviously really important to him. And I think this. There are two things I just want to mention about this. One is, I do think that something broke in the Republican Party when Dobbs happened. I think that when we look back at the election since Dobbs in the spring of 2022, that the Republicans have repeatedly struggled to bring their coalition together. They've struggled to raise hard dollars. That there's been a big chunk of the Republican Party that is all of a sudden like, I'm not so sure about this MAGA thing anymore, right? The non-MAGA part of the Republican Party. They've gone too far. It's become dangerous. And so this has been very central to our politics, maybe the most central thing to our politics in the last 2 years. And if you're just an average voter now, right, what you're seeing is that it's getting worse. MAGA is getting more dangerous. It's getting more scary, right? It's now, within the next month, people in both Arizona and Florida are going to go from having full access to abortion to zero, because of the right-wing ideological movement in the United States. And so I think this is a huge problem because it reinforces the danger of MAGA, the escalating danger of MAGA, that they're not going to just stop with this. They're going to go, you know, if you want to say, look, this is just the beginning, and they're going to take away IVF and birth control and take away your right to vote. That argument has been dramatically reinforced right in the last week. And so I think this goes way beyond just Florida and Arizona, and it reaffirms what an unbelievable escalating threat MAGA is to the freedoms and liberties of the American people.
Well, let me bring up another subject that I've noticed you've brought up, Simon, and I've been very glad to see that you do it. Obviously, I'm a foreign policy nerd, so I follow what's going on with national security and so forth. And in the course of this week, what have we seen? We've seen Ukraine fall further and further behind. Russia increase its bombardment of Ukraine. There are reports now that Russia has 10-to-1 advantage in terms of the ammunition that is there, because Donald Trump and Mike Johnson are blocking aid to Ukraine. Meanwhile, we have an increased likelihood that the Russians are going to try to involve themselves in our upcoming elections. And Donald Trump has led the Congress to blocking a vital law that enables us to identify foreign bad actors within our system. And he has lied about the whole thing. But we are worse off today because Donald Trump is actually impacting U.S. foreign policy now, before he is the president of the United States. Now, Tari, you're out there. You do these local newsrooms. Does this resonate at all?
It's a really good question. I will say it is not top of mind for our audiences that we hear from. It's not something that, you know, when we're dealing with what we are in Arizona this week and in other state courts and state legislatures, the thing that is the priority of our reporters to cover. It obviously is incredibly important. And I think it's a responsibility of all of us and all media too, to make sure that people understand not just the breaking news related to this or certain statements, but the implications of having a president or administration that would be this close to Putin, this opposed to supporting Ukraine and being able to support democracies around the world, and what that tells us about the plans and the positions of Trump and the Republican Party today to deny that support and aid. I think it's also challenging, though, truly, to talk about this, because I do think that Americans are still feeling squeezed by rising costs and pricing and housing affordability and things like that. And so it's very difficult to talk about foreign aid with a lot of audiences that are not as engaged in this, right? When it is a powerful message on the other side to say, why would we give hundreds of millions or billions of dollars, to Kyiv instead of to our own public school systems or our own communities? It's really a challenging conversation to thread. But I think it's so, so essential that when we're talking about democracy and we're talking about the real stakes of this election and we're talking about what we need to be talking about, which is what a Biden administration 2.0 or a Trump administration 2.0 would actually do if and when in office, and what that means for our positioning in the world and then just the state of democracy here and around the world, we have to be able to draw those connections for folks. It's just not, it's not as easy and is not as, visceral necessarily as some of these policies and these positions that are actually impacting people's lives every day.
Yeah, no question, Simon, that that's true. And we've had some unsettling inflation news, which you may or may not want to address. But in terms of the national security issue, what worries me is that we're going to get to the middle of the summer, that this is not going to be funded, and that Ukraine is going to start to collapse in a big way. And that's going to be on the front page of the newspapers. And it's going to be 100% Donald Trump's fault. But people are going to bring it to the doorstep of the president. I think it's very important that we communicate what's happening here. I think, you know, from the point of view of Tara's last point, you know, it's also true that what we're talking about here is a fraction of a percent of what our overall budget is to support this. And foreign aid is always less than 1% of the U.S. budget to begin with. But more importantly, if Russia, you know, gets ahead of steam and makes big gains in Ukraine, there are further conflicts on the horizon that they have promised where U.S. troops are going to be involved, and the costs are going to be many times this. Is there a way to raise awareness on this, Simon?
Yeah, we're going to have to, because, you know, I often talk about how one of our challenges is to describe the nature of the conflict that we're really in today. I think it's been challenging for us, and I give Joe Biden a lot of credit that at his State of the Union, he began his State of the Union by talking about FDR's Four Freedom speech and the fight, the previous fight 80 years ago to preserve freedom and democracy around the world, or to restore freedom and democracy around the world, 80 years ago. I do think the president is going to have to figure out how to have this a sustained conversation about all of this to the American people, because it is a threat to us. I mean, our democracy is under unprecedented threat. And I think that what Trump represents, I mean, what I think you wrote a piece, which I haven't read yet, David, but if you really unpack what Trump is doing and what he's saying he wants to do, he wants to end American power around the world, by essentially weakening the United States in the eyes of our allies and having us run away from an ally like Ukraine and bow down to Putin. He's clearly aligned with Putin, as is RFK, and we're going to have to talk more in the future about how RFK kind of outed himself as an agent of the Russian government in the last 10 days in kind of a shocking way in the language he's using and the arguments he's making. But also Trump wants to destroy the global economy and America's economic power by putting in 10% of tariffs across the board. And what we have to recognize that Donald Trump is promising to end America. He's going to end America's influence around the world. He's going to end the global economy that's made us wealthy. He's going to end American democracy here at home. He is acting as close to an agent of the Russian government as one could possibly construct And this is something that is fair game. We have to have this conversation. We have an obligation, in my view, to have this conversation with the American people because it's so naked. And on Friday night, Mike Johnson is going down to Mar-a-Lago, or on Friday afternoon, and they're going to have a press conference about election security, right? Donald Trump and Mike Johnson. What in the world is that going to be about? Is that going to be about what Robert Kennedy said last Friday, that he's on the side of the persecute, you know, he's defending Snowden and Julian Assange and the January 6th, people who've been jailed? You know, who would possibly construct as an American and have sympathy for Julian Assange, who acted as a launderer of Russian disinformation into our electorate, working with Russian intelligence, Edward Snowden, who betrayed the country and is living in Moscow, and equating them to the January 6th folks who attacked and tried to overthrow American government, that these are the virtuous people in this pantheon of virtuous people in their world? This is very much with us, and it is a danger. And we, as responsible Americans, have an obligation to share what we know with other Americans because it's about the future of their kids and their grandkids. Because we're in a very tough conflict, and I think we're going to have to start raising our game, David.
Yeah, absolutely right. By the way, speaking of columns on this subject, I wrote one, but Ed Luce, one of our friends and our permanent partners in this whole enterprise here, had a column yesterday in which he pointed out that this is not America first. This is Russia first. It is overtly Russia first. Simon brought up something, Tara, that falls in the category of good news, but I'd like to take a step back get your overview on this and Simon's, and that is third parties, because clearly in a close race between Trump and Biden, the role a third party can play can be quite disturbing. Now, No Labels, which has been a source of a lot of criticism from us over the months, turned out to be a dog that did not bark. And that's great. Glad to have them out of the picture. But we still do have in the picture RFK Jr. and Cornel West and so on. And each one of them poses a special kind of a challenge. RFK Jr. has very high name recognition. He's going to have a lot of money for his campaign. But it seems to me that he has presented himself as, Trump's mini-me, that he is not going to appeal to any Democrat or independent of any sort because he just sort of spouts Trumpy stuff. Cornel West is another issue. I don't think many people are thinking of him, but there have been some recent polls that say some portion of Black voters are uncomfortable with Biden. And if only a few of them move away or do not vote, that's a problem. So talk to me about your view on the third party thing, and then we'll turn to Simon.
Yeah, I mean, a formidable third party candidate, and when I say formidable, I don't mean that they could win, because there is no scenario in which a third party candidate could actually win the presidential election. Really, all they can do is wreak havoc on it and potentially throw the election to Trump. We saw this in 2016. I was working on the 2016 election at Priorities. We were the super PAC that was tasked with trying to address the third party threat and challenge. I will say it was too little too late. The amount of votes that Jill Stein got in that election were enough to hand that election to Donald Trump. We can't forget that. And she did not have the name ID or the attention from the press that RFK Jr. does. The fact that he leads with Kennedy as his name, one of our newsletters, For What It's Worth, reported this 2 weeks ago. He has the largest presence on TikTok of any U.S. politician. He has not been slow to build enormous name recognition and engagement and attention. And the biggest issue here is among younger voters, in my opinion, who are going to play an outsized role in determining this election and who, by and large, do not identify as partisan or with either party. They align related to issues and values and are very proudly, I think over 40% say that they're independent. And so, pairing that with, not as much civic education or knowledge about the Electoral College or how presidential elections are decided, or just protest votes that people are doing, really RFK could throw this election to Trump if enough people who would not have voted for Trump turn out to vote for him because they want something different and something about his machismo approach paired with a Kennedy name is attracted to them. That's a really, really, really serious threat. I know that there are efforts that have popped up on the Democratic side, including a super PAC, Clear Choice PAC that's come out to oppose RFK Jr. I think the key strategy here is that he needs to become an asset. So to your point, David, he is out there sounding a lot like Trump. He's appealing to Trump voters. He also, though, is appealing to other voters with other messaging. And then there's so much that a lot of low information voters that will decide the election don't know about him or his conspiracy theories or his past or his ties to Russia. So I really feel as though that there is an enormous amount of education that has to be done. And we can't wait until that threat is even more on the surface than it is. There needs to be a lot of intentionality to make sure that Americans, especially in the battleground states, know really what he stands for. And that ideally, if he's going to stick it out in this race, which he's clear to do with the VP candidate he chose and the resources she has to pump into this campaign over time, that he needs to become an asset and only take votes from Trump and not take votes from Biden or not bring new votes to the table that could really skew the outcome. So I think this is really, really serious. I think that there's a lot of work to be done because he's largely defined himself in a vacuum to voters who did not know him or know about his positions or his tendency towards conspiracy theories.
Yeah, I'd love to see an ad out there. I'm really good with ads, by the way. People want some ideas. They should come to me. But I would love to see an ad out there saying, are you uncomfortable with voting for Donald Trump, but you want to pick somebody who is has your right-wing values? Vote for RFK Jr. You know, just let's use him to peel some votes off of them. What about this alleged softening in African-American support for President Biden's son?
So, as I said earlier, the most important thing for people to realize right now is that Biden's poll numbers are going up, right? I mean, the whole theory that I and the campaign and many people had who've been in this business for a long time was the expectation is that once the general election began, and it was Biden versus Trump, that, you know, some of our wandering coalition would come home, and then we had a campaign to go get the rest. And I think that's what we're seeing. I mean, I think that, you know, there is no question that some of, you know, Biden's at 42, 43, 44. He got 51% of the vote last time. So, I mean, the coalition has not come back together. But it is beginning to. And I, you know, I've been on this, your podcast saying, I thought that by the spring we'd be up by a couple points. I mean, we've now had a bunch of polls showing Biden up 3, up 4 in the last couple of weeks. And we also, I just want to say about the state polling is that there actually hasn't been that much state polling. The last major poll was paid for by Rupert Murdoch and conducted by Trump's pollster, the Wall Street Journal poll. We can't put any stock in that. And there now is polling in the states just in the last few weeks showing Biden ahead in Pennsylvania, ahead in Michigan, ahead in Wisconsin. We've now just had in the last 48 hours, two polls in North Carolina showing the race within margin of error. There are both high quality, serious polls, right, showing Trump only up 2 or 3 points. In the Quinnipiac poll, Josh Stein, our gubernatorial candidate, was up 8 points. If Josh Stein wins by 8 points, we're going to win. Biden is going to win and carry North Carolina. And so, you know, I would say that on balance, things are getting better. We have a lot of work to do. You know, there's too much of our coalition that has wandered. What Tara was getting at is that there's been communication happening to parts of our coalition without us responding properly. I want to say, though, I want to give, you know, a shout out to Biden World. I think their initial digital operation has been, you know, really good. They've been given a long leash. They're being very creative. They're being very aggressive. You know, a lot more has to happen, but I'm very encouraged by what I'm seeing out of what's called Biden-Harris HQ, the digital team that they have that creates organic content. This is not digital ads, right? This is the original digital content that I think is doing a phenomenal job. And I think it's honestly, it's one of the reasons I'm most kind of quietly confident or enthusiastic about Biden World, which is that they've actually done a really good job taking Joe Biden and turning him into a digital asset for us. We obviously have so much more we need to do. But I, again, I am comfortable with where we are in this election right now. We have a lot of work to do. You know, at the, I think all the work we have to do is within the normal bounds of what a campaign has to do. I think what they have to do, which is to make this guy look like a serious presidential candidate again, is not within the normal bounds of what a political campaign has to do. And so it's another reason why I'm quietly confident about where we are right now.
Yeah. And by the way, you know, on Monday, they start jury selection for a trial in New York. That's going to be pretty salacious, not to mention significant. I'm interested in your view, Tara, on the digital side, because that's something you know a lot about. I've been struck, too, by the fact that they've been real good. They had an operation responding to things on the Hill, and they were doing it in real time. They've got this Biden-Harris HQ operation. It seems to me to be real good. And what's more, Joe Biden, it works. And we've talked about it here. I've written about it. You know, as a digital asset, he in some respects works better. You know, you're up close, you're seeing his interaction with people. You're able to create a narrative that's sort of truer to him than you might in a staged event.
I think that's true. I agree with all of this. I mean, I think the campaign's doing a great job. I think that they have been unleashed a bit more to be more in the culture, which is good. That's how you drive engagement and eyeballs. I will say, not to be a Debbie Downer entirely, but I got to contrast our hopium a little bit. There have been some really, really serious and dangerous platform changes over the past few weeks. So Instagram made a change with their last update that everybody who as Instagram on their phone has, where now you are automatically opted out of getting political content in your feeds unless you go into your settings. And we have an entire how-to on Courier's Instagram at Courier Newsroom, but you have to actually unclick that to invite political content back into your feeds. The Biden campaign accounts and the official White House accounts and the official accounts of the president are included and defined as political content. And so Meta has made a policy decision to literally lower and limit the reach of content out of these accounts to the people on these platforms. That is a significant move. That is them, you know, again, in their PR strategy to say, look, no matter what happens in the election, you can't say that we played a role because we actually responded to what our users say they want, which they're not necessarily saying that they don't want political content. So I think that we have to keep that in mind, that even as good as the content is or the reach and engagement, it is limited. And also, Biden is not going to be the best messenger and brand for all of the voters we do need to still come home or to vote for the first time who are new voters. And so that has to be done by issue groups that have to pick up that slack there, by other advocates and surrogates, where he's not going to be the best messenger, their campaign won't be the best brand because of the polarization in this country and how many people are turned off. Again, why why third party is a threat is the same reason that we also need all sorts of diverse voices and people and surrogates and trusted messengers out there who have reach and influence within their communities, really, really, really towing the line for this administration.
Yeah, no question about that. And by the way, the vice president is a good voice in this, particularly around this issue that's going to be so central, which is fundamental rights and freedoms of women that are being stripped away. Okay, we have 1 minute left. 30 seconds from each of you between now and the next time we see you in a couple of weeks, Simon. What should people keep an eye on, you know, sort of in the April-May window of this election?
I think the Trump thing is a real mess. And the question of whether there's continues to be sort of degradation of the enterprise, of the collective enterprise. I mean, his stock of his new company has plummeted. The RNC is in unbelievable turmoil. He's about to have a bad legal case. I mean, I really do think there's a 25-30% chance that he collapses completely as a political figure in this election cycle. And I think he's much closer to that than we all understand. And I know this may sound crazy, right? But I just think the ugliness of his thing is just, it's unrelenting, right? He just had one of the worst political weeks that a politician's had in modern American history, what just happened with Florida and with Arizona and his completely incompetent, imbecilic way of managing it. And, you know, the idiocy is very strong with MAGA and with him. And I think you saw that, you know, on display this week. So I think the question of whether or not, you know, there is a growing awareness that the Orange Emperor has no clothes and that this is the ugliest political thing we've ever seen is growing in my view. And I, look, I've been doing a lot of national television, and this argument I'm making is getting a lot of receptivity that, you know, this guy, this is just an ugly, incompetent, crazy mess. You know, as I called it on CNN a couple of days ago, it's an unprecedented dumpster fire. And I think there's just a growing awareness of that. And I think he may, if this trial goes badly for him, right, it may really reinforce that this is just far too ugly for the American people to really get rallied behind.
I, by the way, have believed this for a long time. I'm glad to hear you say it. Is it a 20 to 30% chance? I don't know. But it's a real possibility. We've never seen anything like this. What are you looking at, Tara?
No, that's right. I was going to say, I think the most important thing over the next few weeks is the trial that starts on the 15th. The amount of things that Trump's lawyers have thrown to try to prevent him from having to testify in this, from having this trial to go forward at this time and have been rejected and failed, shows how much they don't want this to proceed. And it is. And we know we did an enormous amount of coverage and content and testing around the January 6th hearings. A lot of people moved away from him. We also know recent polling and research shows that a lot of the same people that don't mind the convictions or the indictments, the people who don't mind the indictments as much, they will move away from him if he is convicted. This trial will give an enormous amount of material to be able to reinforce this, and it will be a national story. It will be a story that people won't be able to ignore if the media does their job. And I think that that is really, really important, because I think that he will lose more people in this process. And I think that they're aware of that, and they're really spooked about it. So I don't know that I share the hope that 20 to 30% chance that he totally implodes. I hope so. I do hope. I want that hopium in my veins. he seems to just be Teflon in so many of these states. But again, this is really, really important. And this is about justice. And this is about convicting him on election interference. And I do think that that will bring some people to their senses about this.
Well, I'd say after we get off the podcast, I will connect you to my hopium hookup. You can just guess who that is. I'm sure he'll be able to work wonders with you. For now,
I do private consultations.
Private.
Oh, I know. We're buyers.
I know.
You hear that, folks? This is going to be Simon's tickets to wealth and fame. He will come to your house and make you feel better. In any event, we will have you guys back in a couple weeks, as we will throughout the campaign, because we love you and we think you're smart, and it's great to talk to you. For now, thank you, Tara. Thank you, Simon. Thank you, everybody, for listening, and bye-bye.